it's just an old white guy behind a curtain making you believe in miracles, and you really just have it in you to begin with.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So we really try to bring you a lot of different perspectives on this show, and I thought that with all the talk about AI and automation and basically nobody other than a robot having a job in a few years, I thought it was interesting maybe if we looked at a counterpoint to that argument, you know? So introducing Shannon McLay, she is the founder of The Financial Gym. And after years of working for a big bank, including working as a financial advisor for Merrill Lynch, she was inspired to create a financial services company that actually cared for its clients. Imagine that. And provided them the services that they needed. And the result is that 90% of their clients achieve their financial goals. Now, I thought that this was really an interesting person to talk to because Shannon, first off, you'll see she's very engaging, but also the fact that technology is great for the DIYer, but most of us out there need a human to turn to for financial guidance. And I think that more and more we are seeing that it's going to be this marriage of technology and humanity that's going to light the way towards the future. And I think that Shannon is a great counterpoint, like I said, to the argument that automation will be everything within like the next 14 days, like a lot of people are saying. So it's a great conversation, but I'll let you be the judge. And Shannon, take it away.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
It's going to be great to jump into this. And I think first thing I wanted to ask, what I ask everybody, is to say your name and your title and what the heck you do on a day-to-day basis.
Shannon McLay, founder and CEO of The Financial Gym. On a great day, I say, changing the world and helping people become financially healthier every single day. On a bad day, I say,
and I think it often kind of feels that way when you're starting something and when you're building a movement, and you just kind of have to sometimes take a step away from it after a little bit, right? And then just kind of realize how far you've been able to build this thing.
Yeah, I mean, the big picture has been a big picture for the last 6 years, but it's the day-to-day grind that is always the challenging part of it. And so I'm always happiest when I'm moving the business in the direction that that I've wanted it to go for the last 6 years. But the reality is day to day, it's just a lot of grind and herding cats.
And as somebody who sold an agency they were running for about 6 years exactly, I know all the gray hairs that come along with that. But hats off to you, especially considering the fact that you're trying to change the way that people think about something in the process. So can you tell us a little bit about how you got the initial idea? And I know some of this already, but I find it a really cool origin story and the fact that you're making people think differently about finance.
Yeah, I mean, I say all the time, I had no intention of ever starting a business. I love when I meet the serial entrepreneur and people who, you know, say they had lemonade stands when they were kids and, you know, everything, like they were just had that entrepreneurial spirit. I never had that. I had a very practical spirit. I was a business major in college at 23 years ago. I went to college and said, I'm going to be a business major because it was the most practical career path. I knew I would get a job afterward. And I did. I got a job in investment banking right out of college and worked in that for about 8 years. And then got to the point where I felt like I needed a financial advisor. And I was working with Merrill Lynch financial advisors. And I thought it would be really easy to find my own because I'm working with them. And I tell people in the process of looking for myself for an advisor that I became woke to the financial advisory space. And realizing that 85% are men. And I always say there's nothing wrong with that. I married a man. I birthed a man. I love men. But it felt really unfair that if somebody wanted to find something different, it was really hard. And I was one of those, you know, it just felt in one of those, like, if you can't beat them, join them kind of moments. So I became a financial advisor at Merrill Lynch because I wanted to change the face of financial advisory. That's what I told myself. I wanted to help it be a safe place for more women. And then I became an advisor, and to work with me at Merrill Lynch, you had to have 250,000 in assets. And I never thought anything of that. I thought I'd always been around money because I worked in investment banking. So I thought this is going to be really easy. And I did bring in high net worth clients. And I laugh thinking about starting it because my quote mentors at Merrill Lynch, I'm saying mentors because they really weren't the best mentors, but the people that were assigned to me would advise me to not take meetings with people unless I pre-screened them and knew that they had money before I even met with them, because otherwise it was going to be a waste of time. And I dismissed their advice because I said, I've got plenty of time and somebody wants to meet with me, I'm happy to meet with them. And in one of my first meetings of what I would eventually call my pro bono clients, this woman said, I have $250,000 of student loan debt and I make $50,000 a year and not the six-figure job my law school promised me I would make. And I honestly feel unlovable because of all this debt. Who would want to marry me with all the student loan debt? And it was this eye-opening meeting for me. I'd never heard anything like that. And I couldn't do a plan for her at Merrill, but I wanted to help her. So I did this kind of ad hoc financial plan for her in a Word document. And then started to hear more and more stories and meet more and more pro bono clients. And, you know, realizing the majority of America is more like them than the 250,000 people. And I was doing that. And I tell people becoming the worst financial advisor ever because I loved the pro bono business versus the high net worth business. And I did that for a while until I had my Oprah aha week of my life, the true aha for the gym, where this week started with a quarterly review with a couple, and they had over $1 million invested with me, and their portfolio was down 3%, and they were just kind of complaining about where their money was. And I spent an hour of my life making them feel better about being a little less rich. And it was really soul sucking. And I thought, I guess this is what advisors do. They just, you know, talk people off the ledge that's not really that high. And then 2 days later, I did a financial plan for a pro bono client. And the plan's so similar to what we do at the financial gym now. Here's how much you need to save. Here's how you handle your credit cards. Here's how you deal with your student loan debt, and all bulleted points. And at the end of the meeting, she stopped, she looked me in the eye, and she said, you know, you're saving my life, right? And I was like, oh, this feels so much better than that. And who knew a financial plan could save somebody's life? But it was aha so quickly to me that I needed to create a business for people like this, which is the majority of America, and people who are building their wealth or figuring it out and want to speak to a human being and not have to DIY it with some kind of app or a bot. And around the same time, I was on a weight loss journey and I lost over 50 pounds with Weight Watchers and working out. And I remember thinking, you know, I have so many options I could go to get physically healthy. If people want to get physically healthy, we have so many solutions. But if people want to get financially healthy, where would they go? And where would I send these pro bono clients to? And I thought, you would go to a financial gym to get healthy. And I thought right away, it's like H&R Block, but fun and cool. And we're not, there's no advisors, they're financial trainers, they wear jeans and t-shirts. Like, I saw it all really, really clear 6 years ago. And that was 6 years ago. Obviously, it took me some time to get here, but I realized that's the entrepreneur journey that I didn't know I was heading on.
You hit upon, I think, a really interesting trend, and really a number of different trends simultaneously. You know, the fact that there is a little bit more of a disparity, and I don't really see a lot of evidence that that wealth disparity is going down. If anything, the divide is becoming a little bit greater, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, not great necessarily for the U.S., but at the very least, it's pretty good for somebody who's trying to serve the group that's growing faster, I guess. So, I think that is really also, to me, one of the ironic things, I guess you could look at it, is I think, you know, you had to raise money, obviously, to build the financial gym. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, money matters in life. I mean, even when you're trying to start something that's going to help people manage their, money a lot better, ironically, you need money to do that, too. So,
yeah.
I was kind of wondering and wanted to maybe ask you a little bit about, why is raising money important to building the future, you know, if you're any type of entrepreneur?
I think it's raising money. It depends on the type of business you want to create. It depending on, you know, if that's how, you know, depending on the business you want to create will dictate the kind of money and the way you have to raise money to build that. And so the advice I got early on when I wanted to raise money right away, I was like, this is the most brilliant idea ever. I mean, I have gyms across the country, like, let's do this. And, the advice I got from people was, you know, that it sounds like a good idea, but prove that the model works, prove that people pay you to help them with their money, and then you raise money. And so I spent the next 2 years of my life going through everything I own personally, trying to support the family and try to build a business, not charging people a lot of money. And I literally went through everything I own and thought, you know, maybe this is, you know, I need to go back and work for Merrill Lynch. This has been fun. And I had clients for 2 years, but this is crazy. And I, around that time I had coffee with a former boss of mine at Merrill Lynch. And he said, he just got a severance payout. He was getting a severance payout. And he said, what do you think I should do with this money? And I said, I think you should invest in a small financial services startup that's about to run out of money. And he was my first $100,000 check. And we've since now raised $3.6 million for the gym. And I think what's important is to understand what your vision is and what kind of business you want to run. Because for me, 6 years ago, this was always something big. It was always something bigger than me. It was always like gyms across the country. This is a huge need for the majority of America. This has to happen kind of thing. And because the dream and vision was so much bigger than me, I always knew there was going to be money I'd have to raise at some point. The amazing thing for me, though, was how difficult it was to raise money initially. I mean, I just thought, and I can't tell you how many investors I met with who said, you know, you're building something important and it needs to exist, but we're going to pass on this deal. Because the majority of early stage venture capital investors don't want to see a brick and mortar physical location. They want to see some kind of app or thing that's going to grow, you know, have a million subscribers tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. And they don't want to see my kind of model. They hated it. But it was interesting because they hated my model, and yet they would tell me this exists. And I can't tell you how many people, either some of those investors became clients of the gym because they needed help, or they sent personally their loved ones to us to help them get financially healthy. So I love the irony of that, that they don't see it. But what they couldn't see is that it was just really difficult. And actually, it's a very new model, which I didn't realize I was creating something so new and unicorn-like, and investors are scared of that, or at least some investors, because they like to see the replications. Like if I was another scooter company, I could have raised, you know, $10 million right by now, because they like seeing proven tracks. Even if you're the 10th scooter company, they know 9 other scooter companies raised money. So the 10th one will get money too. And
yeah,
they're not very open to seeing the new.
It's true. It's something that I like to joke about and call first mover disadvantage.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you always want to fund like it's going to be like, maybe you don't want to fund the 119th scooter company, but sure, if two or three have gotten funded, it all of a sudden makes your money look a little bit like, I'm not going to lose my shirt. Maybe I'm not going to get an outsized return, and also kind of along the lines of, nobody ever gets fired for hiring McKinsey. It's true.
Yeah.
In that some people just look at it and say, hey, this is not a bad thing to invest in because it's semi-proven. But you're right. When you're trying to do something new and innovate, it becomes more difficult. That's why I was actually interested. You kind of anticipated my follow-up question, which is, how difficult is it when you're trying to essentially create the future in some way and to introduce a new model, to introduce mm-hmm. something that has some inherent challenges with scale? Do you feel that made it difficult, or is making it difficult for you to try to show people this is something that deserves to be in the world?
Well, you know what's interesting that with the term scale, because this is a big problem that VCs have, is they have a very narrow view of scale. They want to see scale in the same way that they've always seen scale, which is those same models. And I remember having this conversation with one of my my early stage investors, because I don't see it scaling is like the it's not you, it's me breakup of a, you know, for a VC person. They're like, we just don't see the scale. That would be the brush off you would get. And I went to this investor and I said, what the hell do they mean by scale or scaling? Like, what is the problem they're seeing? And he said, honestly, Shannon, I don't know, because scale, the definition of scale is the size of the market and your ability to address it. And he said, your market is massive. It's, you know, 70% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. He's like, your market's massive and you are addressing it. I think what issues with some investors have is the way that we scale. It's not the way that they typically see companies scale, but it doesn't mean we can't scale. And the thing is, I don't need a billion users of my app and only because I need a billion because only two people are engaged. I have 2,000 clients and I have 2,000 highly engaged clients. So there's a big difference in the amount of numbers I need for my business to make sense versus the typical VC scaling business. You know, they need like some app to have a million users, just to have five people who will pay, you know, whatever, $5 for something. I mean, I have 2,000 people paying on average $85 a month to work with us.
And I love the way that you think about that. And I think it's kind of almost along the lines of being a podcaster like you and I both are, right? Because you get people who are highly engaged with your content, who are spending a lot of time with you, and you don't need to try to reach every single person because it's a highly intimate experience because they're really, really focused on what you have to say. And I think it's very true in the fact that just like if you have a personal trainer at a physical gym, at an old school gym, I mean, you have a really close relationship with that person and you can't be disengaged with that person because they're going to be able to tell. And it's the same thing true with your business model.
Yeah. I mean, there's a difference between, you know, engagement or not. I think the problem with VCs is that they almost count on high degree of disengagement because that's what they've been throwing so much money at. And I think, again, that's a problem with where a number of them don't see the type of business we're building. But I've gotten very zen about who I raise money from now. And our early seed round investors, it was very painful. Some of those conversations were very painful to try to sell people. Or I've had over the 3.5 million, I've had dozens and dozens of meetings and some very contentious and full of friction about, you know, who do I think I am and how do I think this scales in a very aggressive kind of way. And then the interesting thing that I've noticed is that those people never wrote a check. But then the people that I did meet with who got it, they were like, this is huge. This is everything. This is what the world needs. And ask thoughtful questions and important questions around our business, which I totally want. I want questions around the business, but it's the way they asked it. And so I've told my team, you know, now we're in another raise. And I said, if I just know who's going to be the right fit for us. And if it's a very contentious meeting and they don't see what we're building, I mean, they're not the right partners for us anyway.
Speaking about some of those hard questions that you've been asked in the past, I'd like to ask you the most insanely easy questions ever. Quick lightning round of semi-irreverent stuff. So you up for the challenge?
Oh, yeah, yeah. These will probably be hard for me, right?
let's see. We'll edit out the awkward pauses. So, runner-up name for the financial gym. Did you have any other names that you considered?
The Money Gym or Money Gym was probably a very close. Actually, Money Gym was what I've had since starting Financial Gym, and I've had moments where I'm like, do I change this? I'm like, no, I have the trademark, and we're out there. So, yeah.
Yeah, whatever works, that's what you gotta go with, you know? So,
well, I love that you're asking this because when we went through our branding, we had so many firms that were like, how married are you to the name Financial Gym? And I was like, look, I get that it's part of your ethos to rename us. I was like, but the name's sticking. So come up with something else.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I went through, I think about 60 different names before I settled on Firebrand Group, before I went with that. And then I sold the firm and they pretty soon thereafter renamed it. And it's hard to see. I'm like,
that's like the first thing they do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, everybody wants to put their stamp on something. But so if food had no calories whatsoever and you had to eat the same thing, all the time, what would you eat? Okay.
Pizza.
I was going to say that is the right answer. But yeah, no, I think.
And I have yet to meet a pizza that I don't like. And I'm talking about like the Tostino, like those are pizza bites, like the $1 frozen pizza to, you know, whatever pizza in New York or Chicago, LA, whatever. I love them all.
As a New Yorker who orders from Domino's delivery, you know, I'm not one to judge. So
did Emily tell you I order from Domino's?
No, she did not. But that's really funny. Wow. So I found the other person who does. That's great.
It's the joke at the gym. If I'm working late, I'm like Domino's night. You know, it's fun. I mean, they've come a long way. Talk
they
about
really
a brand
have.
That's come a long
they really
way.
Have.
And it is not the Domino's of yore. And so when people say that they don't like Domino's, I'm like, have you tried it recently? Because
yeah.
They've really come
And when
far.
I was in college, Papa John's was the cool brand.
Papa John's, that was
not
it.
Not so much anymore. No comment.
I went to Wake Forest and we had Papa John's, like, I knew your dorm room number and I loved it. Yeah. And they've got, and the quality's gone downhill too. I mean, not surprising with the challenges
they've
had. Oh,
of course,
had,
absolutely. And what is the, given that you've been around a lot of financial advisors in your life, what is the biggest misconception around financial advisors?
Oh, that they know more than you do. Or they're like this wise and all wise and knowing creatures. I tell people that I had that same impression when I was becoming a financial advisor. I tell people I was kind of like Dorothy in the Wizard of Oz. I thought that they were like this, you know, the wizard and all this magic and special things. And then I became a financial advisor and realized it's just an old white guy behind a curtain making you believe in miracles. And you really just have it in you to begin with. They don't know that much more than you. Most of them were selling cars or something else before they became a financial advisor because they're looking for the traditional advisory space is looking for people who are good at selling things. Because they want to sell you products. And, you know, they have a little bit more education about asset allocation and what to do about it. And, you know, there's plenty of podcasts and resources where you can get educated and more educated on what they're doing. And you can do it yourself. I mean, some are great, though. I also don't want to feel like I'm bashing advisors because I do think there are a number of great ones out there. I think they're harder to come by. And, you know, I tell people ask me, does it make sense to pay for an advisor? And I always say, if you feel like you're getting value from your advisor is doing something more than just manage your money, because a robo-advisor can do that for you for a lot less. But if they're doing more and helping you kind of organize your life and make smarter choices and live a better life over time, then they're totally worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's funny that you even mentioned podcasts, because that was my next question. Since you are in the space and you've been, you know, podcasting for a while, are there any favorite podcasts that you listen to on an ongoing basis?
Dirty little secret about me is I have a podcast and I'm like an OG podcaster. Somebody told me that recently. I've had the podcast for 4 years now. I rarely listen to podcasts, but I do love, there are certain like episodes that I love. And when people ask me about investing in particular or about money, like other podcasts, I have a money podcast. I love Be Wealthy and Smart by Linda P. Jones. She really explains investing in a great way. Stacking Benjamins is very irreverent, but fun kind of money podcast and run by a former advisor, Joe Saul-Sehy, that I love. And then for me, like when I'm going through a rough time, Oprah's Super Soul Conversations is like, it's like chicken soup for my soul. I kind of need it. But I try and want to get into more, but I don't, on my commutes in, I it's more of a meditation. I try to quiet my brain as much as possible. And I feel like, the podcast sometimes is like too much because I already have too much going on in my brain. So a lot of times on my downtime, I'm just trying to like not think about things or hear things.
No, I hear you on that. Absolutely.
Oh. But you know what's amazing, Jeremy, is I've got people who are like, you know, listeners who are like, I binged, like if they just found, you know, my show and I have longer episodes and they're like, I binge listened to like, you know, 50 episodes. And I'm like, holy crap, you have a lot of time on your hands. I was like, that's a lot. Like, I don't want to hear my voice that much. How did you do that? But you know, God bless.
Yeah,
I mean,
I
to
get
each their
very
own.
whenever people are like that they've listened to two in a row. I mean, we're biased because we probably don't like to listen to our voices after a while, but apparently other people are okay with it. So God bless them. So I just want to actually shift gears towards talking about, like, it sounds like you put a lot of thought into obviously building, you know, the financial gym into a company and then proving out the business model, which I think is, you know, hats off, especially for something that wasn't proven out so much. So I know you have some kind of more direct competitors and some, you know, indirect competitors, but you had to really be able to see something out there that not everybody else saw, which is difficult to do. So hats off to that. What I want to ask is almost the flip side of that is, as you built this out, how do you correct for your own biases? Like, every entrepreneur has a certain sense of this is what is going to take off in the marketplace. And then you get some information in from your customer, and then you start to figure out actually what they need is slightly different, a little bit more of this, a little bit less of that. So how did you correct for your own biases in order to better build a, you know, future-proof organization?
I think the way that I've done it, continue to do it, and will always do it and make my team do it, is honestly the reason why I started the business and I saw a need, is that I actually listened to our customers. I tell people I didn't create a business for a VC to invest in. I didn't even realize until 2 years into my business that I was building a business that VCs wouldn't like. I built my business because I heard clients say they wanted to pay me to help them with their money. And that's what I wanted to build for them, because they wanted to pay. I was listening, you talk about the voice of the customer. That's what I was listening to, the customer. And it's been like that since day one. So I start this business and I have in my head, it's going to be a 1 year plan. When I first left, I said, it's going to be a 1 year plan. It's going to be $500 and that's it. And then client number one at the gym came to me. She was in a book club with my sister. And I said, it's $500, 1 year plan. She said, well, that's kind of pricey for me. You know, I'm not sure I could afford it. And I was like, okay, well, you know, have a nice life. And then I wasn't getting a lot of other customers. And I was like, what the heck? I'm the boss. Like, I could make up something. Like, why am I saying I can't do this? So I created what I call the Kickstarter plan. We still have the Kickstarter plan at the gym. And it was a one-time fee to do a plan for her for $250. And we would do a one-year check-in. And she said, okay, that I can do. You know, I'll do the, she didn't want to make the $500 commitment, but she can make the $250 commitment. So I said, great. And then she referred client number two, who also did the $250, but then client number two referred her boyfriend, who paid the $500. And he's like, I need somebody to ride my ass. So that, you know, listening to customer A, to start the business, B, to price the business. And then what was happening is I would get to the end of a 1 year with people and I was like, okay, this is, you know, have a nice life. And they were like, well, we can still keep working together, right? And I was like, oh yeah, this is more than a 1 year thing. This is a lifestyle thing. And so it's just listening to the customer, it really is the biggest lesson that I got. And pretty early on is, you know, what do they want? And can we provide it? And, you know, we know they want compassion, empathy. I know that they want people that look like them and sound like them and, you know, somebody who understands what they're going through. So that's, you know, very intentional with our hiring. And, you know, they don't want to be pushed and sold anything. It's very intentionally with our warm-up call process. We just listen to your customers that you have now and listen to the customers that you want. And that's the best indicator that takes away your bias, because I didn't build the business for me. I built it for them.
And what do you think? And yeah, I really like that, because I think that you're building something for these consumers. And I think you're also paying attention to all these other market conditions that are going to change what people require and what they're looking for in the future. So I'm wondering what other trends do you see about the future of finance, and in particular, you know, personal finance? What are some things that, not asking you to necessarily put your prediction hat on, but if somebody is trying to have a better understanding of what's to come, then what should they be paying attention to, you know, from a trend standpoint?
I think that people need to understand that personal finance is more personal, and that, you know, I think especially banks and larger financial services companies have wanted to remove that personal aspect and make it more tech and scalable. And I think what they're missing is that their consumer really wants to be engaged and have more of a relationship with them and have a trusting relationship. I think there's some kind of research that says that millennials would more likely accept a financial solution from Apple, Square, or PayPal than they would from, you know, Bank of America or Citigroup. And I think that's really, that should be eye-opening for Citigroup, especially when you look at Apple launching a credit card and people are all excited about it. So I think that the traditional financial services companies need to realize that their competition is going to come and not look like what it's looked like in the past. There's going to be more creative things, and that people want to really get engaged, and they want to get engaged with a brand that they know and trust, and they don't have a lot of that in financial services. So either you've got to figure out a way to build trust and community and you know, connectivity with your consumers, or people like me are going to take them.
And how about from a technical, because obviously that touched upon technology, and I think that was also really in a lot of ways talking about the importance of these brands and how much trust has been built up in these brands. But are there any particular technologies around the financial world that people should be paying attention to, or even that you find interesting?
I think it's interesting that there is plenty of technology. There's plenty of fintech out there, and it's almost paralyzing for people. I think what we're seeing at the financial gym and what most of financial services is missing is that there's a lot of emotion around people's money. And so they actually don't necessarily want to engage directly, especially women don't want to necessarily engage directly with the apps and the technology, or they don't feel comfortable with it because their money's personal. So, you know, it takes away that personal connectivity for them. I mean, I have clients who I've told them, you know, they have to open up a high yield savings account at Ally Bank, and they're like, oh, okay, where's the nearest branch? And I'm like, it's an online bank. And these are millennial, they're 28 years old. I'm like, go online. And, you know, I have another client who's 27. She's like, I told her to open a new Citibank account. She's like, okay, I'm going to go to the branch near me. And I'm like, why would you go to, I mean, I came from banking, and they really want more handholding and holding and relationships. So I actually think that they need to focus on less tech in the banking and the finance world, and more like education and quality and content than tech.
No, that makes sense. And I think that there are certain things, this is what I always try to tell people, is when you're trying to figure out where things are going, it's not just important to know about what are the technologies of tomorrow. It's also important to understand what is inherently, you know, the human condition, what goes into consumer psychology. You know, there are certain things that make us who we are. You know, we're innately these biological mm-hmm. creatures who are wired to react to certain things. So you might create the world's best innovation, but I think about Google Glass as not necessarily the world's best innovation, but the moment I saw that, I'm like, okay, yeah, not ready for prime time, you know, because you're going to kind of mm-hmm. creep people out, and we weren't quite ready for it. So you have to understand, is this mm-hmm. a step forward, and is this something that's going to be acceptable to people? So one other last question I wanted to ask you is, what types of, and obviously this is something where, you know, you've kind of been ahead of the market a little bit in understanding this personalization and this service element that's going back to the masses, and how everybody's really expecting more from the institutions that they work with. But what do you see over the next few years, particularly with respect to personal finance that people should be aware of? Are there any other particular trends that people should be paying attention to, or that you're just paying attention to because you know that they're going to impact your company as it grows?
I mean, I really think that it's realizing that that consumers want to engage in a different way. And you look at some of the larger startups that are figuring it out. So you know, like SoFi, for example, you know, started with nothing but student loans, and then they moved to other products. But then you see SoFi has meetup groups, and they've put a lot of money in their meetup groups because they want to engage with their clients. And then you have Betterment that starts with no advisors, but now they're offering advisors and life coaches. And SoFi, I think, is doing the same thing. And you see that they've all started with this tech, and then they're trying to then now back end relationship on it. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that. And you also see with other startups too. I mean, Warby Parker, there's only so many sunglasses or glasses you can sell until you have to have a physical location. Casper, you know, online went to physical location. I think in general, I think you're going to see more of a movement from, you know, this offline only experience to offline online combination being a true success for a company. And companies that engage in both are going to, you know, win consumer loyalty and keep it. And I think it's a necessity. If you're in a consumer, a B2C business, finance or otherwise, that you're going to have some kind of combination of online to offline engagement.
Yep, I think that that's spot on. And I think that that's why it's a very exciting time, is because there are just all of these disruptions to pay attention to. And, you know, people who get caught not paying attention to how quickly things are shifting do not want to wake up 5 years from now and realize that they've kind of missed the boat on a few of these massive changes. So anyway, I'll let you go. This was really fantastic, Shannon. So thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Shannon McLay for making the time to join us. And thanks to you all for listening. We really appreciate it. Thanks also, by the way, for doing all the other great things you're doing, like subscribing, rating and reviewing us whenever possible, and telling everybody in your network, because that really does help new people find this show and fall in love. Until next time, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.